at me. Marie looped her arm through mine, deliberately turning her back on Jenya. Come sit with us. I frowned and opened my mouth to protest, but Jenya simply shook her head and said, Go on. You belong with the Ethereali. I'll fetch you after breakfast to give you a tour.
We can show her around, began Marie, but Jenya cut her off.
To give you a tour, as the Darkling requested. Marie flushed.
What are you, her maid?
Something like that, Jenya said, and walked off to pour herself a glass of tea.
Far above herself, said Nadia with a little sniff.
Worse every day,
Marie agreed. Then she turned to me and beamed.
You must be starving.
She led me to one of the long tables, and as we approached, two servants stepped forward to pull our chairs out for us.
We sit here at the right hand of the Darkling, said Marie, pride in her voice, gesturing down the length of the table where more Grisha in blue kefta sat.
The Corporal Kai sit there, she said with a disdainful glance at the table opposite ours, where a glowering Sergei and a few other red-robed figures were eating breakfast. It occurred to me that if we were at the right hand of the Darkling, the Corporal Kai were just as close to him on the left, but I didn't mention that. The Darkling's table was empty, the only sign of his presence a large ebony chair. When I asked if he would be eating breakfast with us, Nadia shook her head vigorously.
Oh, no. He hardly ever dines with us, she said.
I raised my eyebrows. All this fuss about who sat nearest the Darkling, and he couldn't be bothered to show up. Plates of rye bread and pickled herring were placed in front of us, and I had to stifle a gag. I hate herring. Luckily, there was plenty of bread, and I saw with astonishment sliced plums that must have come from a hothouse. A servant brought us hot tea from one of the large samovars.
Sugar!
I exclaimed as he set a little bowl before me. Marie and Nadia exchanged a glance, and I blushed. Sugar had been rationed in Ravka for the last 100 years, but apparently it wasn't a novelty in the little palace. Another group of summoners joined us, and after brief introductions began peppering me with questions. Where was I from? The North. Mal and I never lied about where we were from. We just didn't tell the whole truth. Was I really a mapmaker? Yes. Had I really been attacked by Fjerdens? Yes. How many Volkra had I killed? None. They all seemed disappointed by this last answer, particularly the boys.
But I heard you killed hundreds of them when the skiff was attacked,
protested a boy named Ivo with the sleek features of a mink. Well, I didn't, I said, and then considered. At least, I don't think I did. I, kind of fainted.
You fainted?
Ivo looked appalled. I was exceedingly grateful when I felt a tap on my shoulder and saw that Jenya had come to my rescue. Shall we? She asked, ignoring the others. I mumbled my goodbyes and quickly escaped, conscious of their stares following us across the room. How was breakfast? Jenya asked. Awful. Jenya made a disgusted sound. Herring and rye? I'd been thinking more about the interrogation, but I just nodded. She wrinkled her nose. Vile. I eyed her suspiciously. What did you eat? Jenya looked over her shoulder to make sure no one was within earshot and whispered, One of the cooks has a daughter with terrible spots. I took care of them for her, and now she sends me the same pastries they prepare for the Grand Palace every morning. They're divine. I smiled and shook my head. The other Grisha might look down on Jenya, but she had her own kind of power and influence. Don't say anything about it, Jenya added. The Darkling is very keen on the idea that we all eat hearty peasant fare. Saints forbid we forget we're real Ravkins. I restrained a snort. The little palace was a storybook version of serf life, no more like the real Ravka than the glitter and gilt of the royal court. The Grisha seemed obsessed with emulating surf ways right down to the clothes we wore beneath our kefta. But there was something a little silly about eating hearty peasant fare off porcelain plates beneath a dome inlaid with real gold. And what peasant wouldn't pick pastry over pickled fish? I won't say a word, I promised.
Good. If you're very nice to me, I might even share,
Jenya said with a wink.
Now, these doors lead to the library and the workrooms.
She gestured to a massive set of double doors in front of us.
That way to get back to your room, she said, pointing to the right. And that way to the Grand Palace, she said, pointing to the double doors on the left.
Jenya started to lead me toward the library.
But what about that way? I asked, nodding to the closed double doors behind the Darkling's table. If those doors open, pay attention. They lead to the Darkling's council room and his quarters. When I looked more closely at the heavily carved doors, I could make out the Darkling's symbol hidden in the tangle of vines and running animals. I tore myself away and hurried after Jenya, who was already on her way out of the domed hall. I followed her across a corridor to another set of enormous double doors. This pair had been carved to look like the cover of an old book, and when Jenya pulled them open, I gasped. The library was 2 stories high, its walls lined from floor to ceiling with books. A balcony ran around the 2nd story, and its dome was made entirely of glass so that the whole room glowed with morning light. A few reading chairs and small tables were set by the walls. At the room's center, directly beneath the sparkling glass dome, was a round table ringed by a circular bench.
"You'll have to come here for history and theory," Jenya said, leading me around the table and across the room. "I finished with all that years ago. So boring."
Then she laughed.
"Close your mouth. You look like a trout."
I snapped my mouth shut.
But that didn't stop me from looking around in awe. The Duke's library had seemed so grand to me. But compared to this place, it was a hovel. All of Kerimzin seemed shabby and faded viewed beside the beauty of the little palace. But somehow it made me sad to think of it that way. I wondered what Mal's eyes would see.
My steps slowed.
Were the Grisha allowed guests?
Could Mal come visit me in Os Alta? He had his duties with his regiment, but if he could get leave... The thought filled me with excitement. The little palace didn't seem quite so intimidating when I thought of walking its corridors with my best friend. We left the library through another set of double doors and passed into a dark hallway. Jenya turned left, but I glanced down the hall to the right and saw 2 corporalci emerge from a large set of red lacquered doors. They gave us unfriendly looks before they disappeared into the shadows.
"Come on," Jenya whispered, grabbing hold of my arm and pulling me in the opposite direction.
"Where do those doors lead?" I asked.
"To the anatomy rooms."
A chill rippled through me. The corporalci. Healers and heart renders. They had to practice somewhere, but I hated to think what that practice might entail. I quickened my steps to catch up with Jenya. I didn't want to get caught by myself anywhere near those red doors. At the end of the hallway, we stopped at a set of doors made of light wood, exquisitely carved with birds and blooming flowers. The flowers had yellow diamonds at their centers, and the birds had what looked like amethyst eyes. The door handles were wrought to look like 2 perfect hands. Jenya took hold of one and pushed the door open. The fabricator's workshops had been positioned to make the most of the clear eastern light, and the walls were made up almost entirely of windows. The brightly lit rooms reminded me a bit of a documents tent, but instead of atlases, stacks of paper, and bottles of ink, the large work tables were laden with bolts of fabric, chunks of glass, thin skeins of gold and steel, and strangely twisted hunks of rock. In one corner, terrariums held exotic flowers, insects, and, I saw with a shudder, snakes. The Materialkai, in their dark purple kefta, sat hunched over their work, but looked up to stare their fill at me as we passed. At one table, two female fabricators were working a molten lump of what I thought might become Grisha steel, their table scattered with bits of diamond and jars full of silkworms. At another table, a fabricator with a cloth tied over his nose and mouth was measuring out a thick black liquid that stank of tar. Jenya led me past all of them to where a fabricator hunched over a set of tiny glass discs. He was pale, reed thin, and in dire need of a haircut.
"Hello, David," said Jenya.
David looked up, blinked, gave a curt nod, and bent back to his work. Jenya sighed.
"David, this is Alina."
David gave a grunt.
"The Sun Summoner?"
Jenya added.
"These are for you,"
he said without looking up.
I looked at the discs. "Oh, thank you?"
I wasn't sure what else to say, but when I looked at Jenya, she just shrugged and rolled her eyes.
"Goodbye, David," she said deliberately.
David grunted. Jenya took my arm and led me outside, onto an arched wooden arcade that overlooked a rolling green lawn.
"Don't take it personally," she said. "David is a great metalworker. He can fold a blade so sharp it will cut through flesh like water. But if you're not made of metal or glass, he isn't interested."
Jenya's voice was light, but it had a funny little edge to it, and when I glanced at her, I saw that there were bright spots of color on her perfect cheekbones. I looked back through the windows to where I could still see David's bony shoulders and messy brown hair. I smiled. If a creature as gorgeous as Jenya could fall for a skinny, studious fabricator, there might be hope for me yet.
"What?"
she said, noticing my smile.
"Nothing."
"Nothing?" Jenya squinted suspiciously at me, but I kept my mouth shut. We followed the arcade along the eastern wall of the little palace, past more windows that looked into the fabricator's workshops. Then we turned a corner and the windows stopped. Jenya quickened her pace. "Why aren't there any windows?" I asked. Jenya glanced nervously at the solid walls. They were the only parts of the little palace I'd seen that weren't covered in carvings.
"We're on the other side of the Corporalkai anatomy rooms."
"Don't they need light to do their work?"
"Skylights," she said. "In the roof, like the library dome. They prefer it that way. It keeps them and their secrets safe."
"But what are they doing there?" I asked, not entirely sure I wanted to hear the answer.
"Only the Corporalkai know. But there are rumors that they've been working with the fabricators on new experiments."
I shivered and was relieved when we turned another corner and the windows began again. Through them I saw bedrooms like my own, and I realized I was seeing the downstairs dormitories. I was grateful that I'd been given a room on the third floor. I could have done without all those stairs to climb, but now that I had my own room for the first time, I was glad that people couldn't just walk by my window. Jenya pointed to the lake I'd seen from my room.
"That's where we're going,"
she said, pointing to the little white structures dotting the shore.
"To the summoner's pavilions."
"All the way out there?"
"It's the safest place for your sort to practice. All we need is some overexcited Inferni to burn the whole place down around us."
"Ah," I said. "I hadn't thought about that."
"That's nothing. The fabricators have another place all the way outside the city where they work on blast powders."
"I can arrange for you to have a tour there, too," she said, with a wicked grin. "I'll pass." We descended a set of steps to a gravel path and made our way to the lake. As we approached it, another building became visible on the far shore. To my surprise, I saw groups of children running and shouting around it. Children in red, blue, and purple. A bell rang and they left off their playing and streamed inside.
"A school?" I asked.
Jenya nodded.
When a gracious talent is discovered, the child is brought here for training. It's where nearly all of us learned the small science. Again, I thought of those three figures looming over me in the sitting room at Keremzin. Why hadn't the Grisha examiners discovered my abilities all those years ago? It was hard to imagine what my life might have been like if they had. I would have been catered to by servants instead of working side by side with them at chores. I never would have become a cartographer or even learned to draw a map. And what might it have meant for Ravka? If I'd learned to use my power, the Shadowfold might already be a thing of the past. Mal and I would never have had to fight the Volkra. In fact, Mal and I would probably have long forgotten each other. I looked back across the water to the school. What happens when they finish? They become members of the Second Army. Many are sent to the great houses to serve with noble families, or they're sent to serve with the First Army on the northern or southern front or near the fold. The best are chosen to remain at the little palace to finish their education and join the Darkling service.
What about their families?
I asked. They're compensated handsomely. A gracious family never wants.
That's not what I meant. Don't you ever go home to visit?
Jenya shrugged. I haven't seen my parents since I was 5. This is my home. Looking at Jenya in her white and gold kefta, I wasn't quite convinced. I'd lived at Keremzin for most of my life, but I'd never felt I belonged there. And even after a year, the same had been true for the King's army. The only place I'd ever felt I belonged was with Mal, and even that hadn't lasted. For all her beauty, maybe Jenya and I weren't so different after all. When we reached the lakeshore, we strolled past the stone pavilions, but Jenya didn't stop until we reached a path that wound from the shore into the woods.
Here we are, she said.
I peered up the path. Hidden in the shadows, I could just make out a small stone hut, obscured by trees.
There?
I can't go with you. Not that I'd want to.
I looked back up the path, and a little shiver ran up my spine. Jenya gave me a pitying look.
Bagra's not so bad once you get used to her. But you don't want to be late.
Right, I said hastily, and scurried up the path.
Good luck,
Jenya called out after me. The stone hut was round and, I noted apprehensively, didn't seem to have any windows. I walked up the few steps to the door and knocked. When no one answered, I knocked again and waited. I wasn't sure what to do. I looked back up the path, but Jenya was long gone. I knocked once more, then screwed up my courage and opened the door. The heat hit me like a blast, and I instantly began to sweat in my new clothes. As my eyes adjusted to the dimness, I could just make out a narrow bed, a basin, and a stove with a kettle on it. At the center of the room were two chairs and a fire roaring in a large tile oven.
You're late, said a harsh voice.
I looked around but didn't see anyone in the tiny room. Then one of the shadows moved. I nearly jumped out of my skin.
Shut the door, girl. You're letting the heat out.
I closed the door.
Good, let's have a look at you.
I wanted to turn and run in the other direction, but I told myself to stop being stupid. I forced myself to walk over to the fire. The shadow emerged from behind the oven to peer at me in the firelight. My first impression was of an impossibly ancient woman, but when I looked closer I wasn't sure why I'd thought that at all. Bagra's skin was smooth and taut over the sharp angles of her face. Her back was straight, her body wiry like a Suli acrobat, her coal-black hair untouched by gray. And yet the firelight made her features eerily skull-like, all jutting bones and deep hollows. She wore an old kefta of indeterminate color, and with one skeletal hand she gripped a flat-headed cane that looked like it had been hewn from silvery petrified wood.
So, she said in a low, guttural voice. You're the Sun Summoner. come to save us all. Where's the rest of you?
I shifted uneasily.
Well, girl, are you a mute?
No, I managed.
That's something, I suppose. Why weren't you tested as a child?
I was.
Humph,
she said. Then her expression changed. She looked on me with eyes so unfathomably bleak that a chill rippled through me despite the heat of the room.
I hope you're stronger than you look, girl, she said grimly.
A bony hand snaked out from the sleeve of her robes and fastened hard around my wrist.
Now, she said, let's see what you can do.
Chapter 9. It was a complete disaster. When Bagra fastened her bony hand around my wrist, I realized instantly that she was an amplifier, like the Darkling. I felt the same jolting surety flood through me, and sunlight erupted through the room, shimmering over the stone walls of Bagra's hut. But when she released me and told me to call the power on my own, I was hopeless. She chided me, cajoled me, even hit me once with her stick.
"What am I supposed to do with a girl who can't call her own power?" she growled at me. "Even children can do this."
She slid her hand around my wrist again, and I felt that thing inside me rising up, struggling to break the surface. I reached for it, grasping, sure I could feel it. Then she let go, and the power slipped away from me, sinking like a stone. Finally, she shooed me away with a disgusted wave of her hand. The day did not improve. I spent the rest of the morning at the library, where I was given a towering stack of books on Grisha theory and Grisha history, and informed that this was just a fraction of my reading list. At lunch, I looked for Jenya, but she was nowhere to be found. I sat down at the summoner's table and was quickly swarmed by Ethereal-Kai. I picked at my plate as Marie and Nadia prodded me with questions about my first lesson, where my room was, if I wanted to go with them to the Banya that night. When they realized they weren't going to get much out of me, they turned to the other summoners to chat about their classes. While I suffered with Bagra, the other Grisha were studying advanced theory, languages, military strategy. Apparently this was all to prepare for when they left the little palace next summer. Most of them would travel to the Fold, or to the northern or southern front to assume a command position in the Second Army. But the greatest honor was to be asked to travel with the Darkling, as Ivan did. I did my best to pay attention, but my mind kept wandering back to my disastrous lesson with Bagra. At some point I realized that Marie must have asked me a question, because she and Nadia were both staring at me.
"Sorry, what?"
I asked.
They exchanged a glance.
"Do you want to walk with us to the stables?"
Marie asked.
"For combat training."
Combat training. I looked down at the little schedule Jenya had left with me. Listed after lunch were the words, Combat Training, Botkin, West Stables. So this day was actually going to get worse.
Sure,
I said numbly, and stood up with them. The servants sprang forward to pull our chairs out and clean the dishes. I doubted I'd ever get used to being waited on this way.
Ne prenite,
Maria said with a giggle.
What?
I asked, baffled.
Dos habites abajo, no.
Nadia giggled.
She said, don't worry, it will be fun. It's Suli dialect. Marie and I are studying it in case we get sent west.
Ah,
I said.
Si si Yuyan Suli,
said Sergei as he strode past us out of the domed hall.
That's Shu for Suli is a dead language.
Marie scowled and Nadia bit her lip.
Sergei is studying Shu,
whispered Nadia.
I got that,
I replied. Maria spent the entire walk to the stables complaining about Sergei and the other Korporalkai and debating the merits of Suli over Shu. Suli was best for missions in the Northwest. Shu meant you'd be stuck translating diplomatic papers. Sergei was an idiot who was better off learning to trade in Kerch. She took a brief break to point out the Banya,
An elaborate system of steam baths and cold pools nestled in a birch grove beside the little palace, then launched immediately into a rant about selfish corporalki overrunning the baths every night. Maybe combat training wouldn't be so bad. Marie and Nadia were definitely making me want to punch something. As we were crossing the western lawn, I suddenly got the feeling that someone was watching me. I looked up and saw a figure standing off the path, nearly hidden by the shadows from a low stand of trees. There was no mistaking the long brown robes or the dirty black beard. And even from a distance, I could feel the eerie intensity of the apparat's stare. I hurried to catch up to Marie and Nadia, but I sensed his gaze following me. And when I looked back over my shoulder, he was still there. The training rooms were next to the stables, large, empty, high-beamed rooms with packed dirt floors and weapons of every variety lining the walls. Our instructor, Botkin Yul Erdin, wasn't Grisha. He was a former Shuhan mercenary who had fought in wars on every continent for any army that could afford his particular gift for violence. He had scraggly gray hair and a gruesome scar across his neck where someone had tried to cut his throat. I spent the next 2 hours cursing that person for not doing a more thorough job. Botkin started with endurance drills, racing us across the palace grounds. I did my best to keep up, but I was as weak and clumsy as ever, and I quickly fell behind.
"Is this what they teach in First Army?"
he sneered in his heavy shoe accent as I stumbled up a hill. I was too out of breath to answer. When he returned to the training rooms, the other summoners paired off for sparring drills, and Botkin insisted on partnering me. The next hour was a blur of painful jabs and punches.
"Block!" he shouted, knocking me backward. "Faster! Maybe a little girl likes to be hit."
The sole consolation was that we weren't allowed to use our Grisha abilities in his training rooms. So, at least I was spared the embarrassment of revealing that I couldn't call my power. When I was so tired and sore that I thought I might just lie down and let him kick me, Botkin dismissed the class, but before we were out the door he called,
"Tomorrow, little girl comes early. Trains with Botkin."
It was all I could do not to whimper. By the time I stumbled back to my room and bathed, I just wanted to slink beneath the covers and hide. But I forced myself to return to the domed hall for dinner. "Where's Jenya?" I asked Marie as I sat down at the summoner's table.
"She eats at the Grand Palace."
"And sleeps there," added Nadia. "The queen likes to make sure she's always available."
"So does the king."
"Marie," Nadia protested, but she was snickering. I gaped at them.
"You mean..."
"It's just a rumor," said Marie. But she and Nadia exchanged a knowing look. I thought of the king's wet lips, the broken blood vessels in his nose, and beautiful Jenya in her servant's colors. I pushed my plate away. The little bit of appetite I'd had seemed to have disappeared. Dinner seemed to last forever. I nursed a glass of tea and endured another round of endless summoner chatter. I was getting ready to excuse myself and escape back to my room when the doors behind the Darkling's table opened, and the domed hall fell silent. Ivan emerged and sauntered over to the summoner's table, seemingly oblivious to the stares of the other Grisha. With a sinking sensation, I realized he was walking straight toward me.
"Come with me, Starkov," he said when he reached us,
and added a mocking,
"Please."
I pushed my chair back and rose on legs that felt suddenly weak. Had Bogart told the Darkling that I was hopeless? Had Botkin told him just how badly I'd failed at my lessons? The Grisha were goggling at me. Nadia's jaw was actually hanging open. I followed Ivan across the silent hall and through the huge ebony doors. He led me down a hallway and through another door emblazoned with the Darkling's symbol. It was easy to tell that I was in the war room. There were no windows, and the walls were covered with large maps of Ravka. The maps were made in the old style, with heated ink on animal hide. Under any other circumstances, I could have spent hours studying them, running my fingers over the raised mountains and twisting rivers. Instead, I stood with my hands bunched into clammy fists, my heart thudding in my chest. The Darkling was seated at the end of a long table, reading through a pile of papers. He looked up when we entered, his quartz eyes glittering in the lamplight.
"Alina," he said, "please sit."
He gestured to the chair beside him. I hesitated. He didn't sound angry. Ivan disappeared back through the door, closing it behind him. I swallowed hard and made myself cross the room and take the seat the Darkling offered.
"How was your first day?"
I swallowed again. "Fine," I croaked.
"Really?"
he asked, but he was smiling slightly.
"Even Bagra? She can be a bit of a trial."
"Just a bit," I managed.
"You are tired?"
I nodded.
"Homesick?"
I shrugged. It felt strange to say I was homesick for the barracks of the First Army. A little, I guess.
"It will get better."
I bit my lip. I hoped so. I wasn't sure how many days like this one I could handle.
"It will be harder for you," he said. "An Ethereal Nick rarely works alone. Inferni pair up. Squallers often partner with Tide Makers. But you're the only one of your kind."
"Right," I said wearily. I wasn't really in the mood to hear about how special I was. He rose.
"Come with me," he said.
My heart started pounding again. He led me out of the war room and down another hallway. He pointed to a narrow door set unobtrusively into the wall.
"Keep right, and this will lead you back to the dormitories. I thought you might want to avoid the main hall."
I stared at him. "That's it?" I blurted. "You just wanted to ask me about my day?" He cocked his head to one side.
"What were you expecting?"
I was so relieved that a little laugh escaped me. "I have no idea. Torture? Interrogation? A stern talking to?" He frowned slightly.
"I'm not a monster, Alina, despite what you may have heard."
"I didn't mean that," I said hurriedly. I didn't know what to expect."
"Other than the worst?"
"It's an old habit." I knew I should stop there, but I couldn't help myself. Maybe I wasn't being fair, but neither was he. "Why shouldn't I be afraid of you?" I asked. "You're the Darkling. I'm not saying you would throw me in a ditch or ship me off to Tsibea, but you certainly could. You can cut people in half. I think it's fair to be a little intimidated." He studied me for a long moment, and I wished fervently that I'd kept my mouth shut. But then that half-smile flickered across his face.
"You may have a point."
A little of the fear ebbed out of me.
"Why do you do that?"
he asked suddenly. "Do what?" He reached out and took hold of my hand. I felt that wonderful sense of surety rush through me.
"Rub your thumb across your palm."
"Oh." I laughed nervously. I hadn't even been aware I was doing it. "Just another old habit." He turned my hand over and examined it in the dim light of the hallway. He dragged his thumb over the pale scar that ran across my palm. A shivery hum shot through me.
"Where did you get this?"
he asked. "I... Kerimsen."
"Where you grew up?"
"Yes."
"The Tracker is an orphan, too."
I drew in a sharp breath. Was mind-reading another one of his powers? But then I remembered that Mal had given testimony in the Grisha tent. "Yes," I said.
"Is he any good?"
"What?" I was finding it hard to concentrate. The Darkling's thumb was still moving back and forth, tracing the length of the scar on my palm.
"At tracking. Is he any good at it?"
"The best," I said honestly. The serfs at Kerimsen said he could make rabbits out of rocks.
I wonder sometimes how much we really understand our own gifts, he mused.
Then he dropped my hand and opened the door. He stepped aside and gave me a little bow.
Good night, Alina.
Good night, I managed. I ducked through the doorway and into a narrow hall. A moment later, I heard the sound of a door closing behind me. Chapter 10 The next morning, my body ached so badly that I could barely drag myself out of bed. But I got up and did it all over again. And again, and again. Each day was worse and more frustrating than the one before, but I didn't stop. I couldn't. I wasn't a mapmaker anymore. And if I couldn't manage to become a Grisha, where would that leave me? I thought of the Darkling's words that night beneath the broken beams of the barn. You're the first glimmer of hope I've had in a long time. He believed I was the Sun Summoner. He believed I could help him destroy the Fold. And if I could, no soldier, no merchant, no tracker would ever have to cross the Unsea again. But as the days dragged on, that idea began to seem more and more absurd. I spent long hours in Bagra's hut, learning breathing exercises and holding painful poses that were supposed to help me with my focus. She gave me books to read, teas to drink, and repeated whacks with her stick, but nothing helped.
"Should I cut you, girl?" she would cry in frustration. "Should I have an inferni burn you? Should I have them throw you back into the fold to make food for those abominations?"
My daily failures with Bagra were matched only by the torture that Botkin put me through. He ran me all over the palace grounds, through the woods, up and down hills until I thought I would collapse. He put me through sparring drills and falling drills until my body was covered in bruises and my ears ached from his constant grumbling. Too slow, too weak, too skinny.
"Botkin cannot build house from such little twigs," he shouted at me, giving my upper arm a squeeze. "It's something."
But I wasn't hungry. The appetite that had appeared after my brush with death on the fold was gone, and food had lost all its savor. I slept poorly, despite my luxurious bed, and felt like I was stumbling through my days. The work Jenya had done on me had worn off, and my cheeks were once again sallow, my eyes shadowed, my hair dull and limp. Bagra believed that my lack of appetite and inability to sleep were connected to my failure to call my power.
"How much harder is it to walk with your feet bound, or to talk with a hand over your mouth?" she lectured. "Why do you waste all of your strength fighting your true nature?"
I wasn't, or I didn't think I was. I wasn't sure of anything anymore. All my life I'd been frail and weak. Every day had felt like a struggle. If Bagra was right, all that would change when I finally mastered my Grisha talent, assuming I ever did. Until then, I was stuck. I knew that the other Grisha were whispering about me. The Ethereali liked to practice by the lakeside together, experimenting with new ways to use wind and water and fire. I couldn't risk them discovering that I couldn't even call my own power, so I made excuses not to join them. And eventually, they stopped inviting me. In the evenings, they sat around the domed hall, sipping tea or kvass, planning weekend excursions into Balakirev or one of the other villages near Os Alta. But because the Darkling was still concerned about assassination attempts, I had to remain behind. I was glad for the excuse. The more time I spent with the summoners, the greater the chance that I would be found out. I rarely saw the Darkling, but when I did, it was from a distance, coming or going, deep in conversation with Ivan or the king's military advisers. I learned from the other Grisha that he wasn't often at the little palace, but spent most of his time traveling between the Fold and the northern border, or south, where Shuhan raiding parties were attacking settlements before winter set in. Hundreds of Grisha were stationed throughout Ravka, and he was responsible for all of them. He never said a word to me, rarely even glanced my way. I was sure it was because he knew that I was showing no improvement, that his sun summoner might turn out to be a complete failure after all. When I wasn't suffering at the hands of Bagra or Botkin, I was sitting in the library, wading through books on Grisha theory. I thought I understood the basics of what Grisha did, of what we did, I amended. Everything in the world could be broken down into the same small parts. What looked like magic was really the Grisha manipulating matter at its most fundamental levels. Marie didn't make fire. She summoned combustible elements in the air around us, and she still needed a flint to make the spark that would burn that fuel. Grisha steel wasn't endowed with magic, but by the skill of fabricators who did not need heat or crude tools to manipulate metal. But if I understood what we did, I was less sure of how we did it. The grounding principle of the small science was like calls to like. But then it got complicated. Odinakovost was the thisness of a thing that made it the same as everything else. Etovost was the thatness of a thing that made it different from everything else. Odinakovost connected Grisha to the world, but it was Etovost that gave them an affinity for something like air, or blood, or, in my case, light. Around then, my head started swimming. One thing did stand out to me. The word the philosophers used to describe the people born without Grisha gifts. Otkazatsaya, the abandoned. It was another word for orphan. Late one afternoon, I was plodding through a passage describing Grisha assistance with trade routes, when I felt someone's presence beside me. I looked up and cringed back in my chair. The apparat was looming over me, his flat black pupils lit with peculiar intensity. I glanced around the library. It was empty except for us, and despite the sun pouring through the glass ceiling, I felt a chill creep through me. He sat down in the chair beside me with a gust of musty robes, and the damp smell of tombs enveloped me. I tried to breathe through my mouth.
"Are you enjoying your studies, Alina Starkov?"
"Very much," I lied.
"I'm so glad," he said. "But I hope you will remember to feed the soul as well as the mind. I am the spiritual advisor to all those within the palace walls. Should you find yourself worried or in distress, I hope you will not hesitate to come to me."
"I will," I said. "Absolutely."
"Good. Good."
He smiled, revealing a mouth of crowded, yellowing teeth, his gums black like a wolf's.
"I want us to be friends. It is so important that we are friends."
"Of course.
I would be pleased if you would accept a gift from me," he said, reaching into the folds of his brown robes and removing a small book bound in red leather.
How could someone offering you a present sound so creepy? Reluctantly, I leaned forward and took the book from his long, blue-veined hand. The title was embossed in gold on the cover. Histori Sanctia. "The Lives of Saints?" He nodded.
"There was a time when all Grisha children were given this book, when they came to school at the little palace."
"Thank you," I said, perplexed.
"Peasants love their saints. They hunger for the miraculous. And yet they do not love the Grisha. Why do you think that is?"
"I hadn't thought about it," I said. I opened the book. Someone had written my name inside the cover. I flipped a few pages. Sankt Peter of Brevno. Sankt Ilya in chains. Sankt Elisabetta. Each chapter began with a full-page illustration beautifully rendered in brightly colored inks.
"I think it is because the Grisha do not suffer the way the saints suffer. The way the people suffer."
"Maybe," I said absently.
"But you have suffered, haven't you, Alina Starkov?" "And I think, yes,
I think you will suffer more.
My head jerked up. I thought he might be threatening me, but his eyes were full of a strange sympathy that was even more terrifying. I glanced back down at the book in my lap. My finger had stopped on an illustration of Santa Elisabetta, as she had died, drawn and quartered in a field of roses. Her blood made a river through the petals. I snapped the book closed and sprang to my feet.
I should go.
The apparat rose, and for a moment I thought he would try to stop me.
You do not like your gift.
No, no, it's very nice. Thank you. I don't want to be late, I babbled. I bolted past him through the library doors, and I didn't take an easy breath until I was back in my room. I tossed the Book of Saints into the bottom drawer of my dressing table and slammed it shut. What did the apparat want from me? Had his words been meant as a threat? Or as some kind of warning? I took a deep breath, a tide of fatigue and confusion washing over me. I missed the easy rhythm of the documents tent, the comforting monotony of my life as a cartographer, when nothing more was expected of me than a few drawings and a tidy work table. I missed the familiar smell of inks and paper. Mostly, I missed Mal. I'd written to him every week, care of our regiment, but I hadn't heard anything back. I knew the post could be unreliable and that his unit might have moved on from the fold or might even be in West Ravka, but I still hoped that I would hear from him soon. I'd given up on the idea of him visiting me at the little palace. As much as I missed him, I couldn't bear the thought of him knowing that I fit into my new life about as well as I'd fit into my old one. Every night as I climbed the stairs to my room after another pointless, painful day, I would imagine the letter that might be waiting for me on my dressing table, and my steps would quicken. But the days passed, and no letter came. Today was no different. I ran my hand over the empty surface of the table. "Where are you, Mal?" I whispered, but there was no one there to answer.
Chapter 11.
When I thought things couldn't get any worse, they did. I was sitting at breakfast in the domed hall when the main doors blew open and a group of unfamiliar Grisha entered. I didn't pay them much attention. Grisha in the Darkling service were always coming and going at the little palace, sometimes to recover from injuries received at the northern or southern front, sometimes on leave from other assignments. Then Nadia gasped.
"Oh, no,"
groaned Marie. I looked up and my stomach lurched as I recognized the raven-haired girl who had found Mal so fascinating back in Krybirsk.
"Who is she?"
I whispered, watching the girl glide among the other Grisha, saying her hellos, her high laugh echoing off the golden dome.
"Zoya," muttered Marie. "She was a year ahead of us at school, and she's horrible."
"Think she's better than everyone," added Nadia. I raised my eyebrows. If Zoya's sin was snobbery, then Marie and Nadia had no business making judgments. Marie sighed.
"The worst part is that she's kind of right. She's an incredibly powerful squaller, a great fighter. And look at her."
I took in the silver embroidery on Zoya's cuffs, the glossy perfection of her black hair, the big blue eyes fringed by impossibly dark lashes. She was almost as beautiful as Jenya. I thought of Mal and felt a pang of pure jealousy shoot through me. But then I realized that Zoya had been stationed at the fold. If she and Mal had... well, she might know if he was there, if he was all right. I pushed my plate away. The prospect of asking Zoya about Mal made me a little nauseated. As if she could feel my stare, Zoya turned from where she was chatting with some awestruck corporalkai and swept over to the summoner's table.
"Marie, Nadia, how are you?"
They stood to hug her, their faces plastered with huge fake smiles.
"You look amazing, Zoya. How are you?" gushed Marie.
"We missed you so much," squealed Nadia.
"I missed you too," Zoya said. "It's so good to be back at the little palace. You can't imagine how busy the Darkling kept me. But I'm being rude.
I don't think I've met your friend."
"Oh," Marie exclaimed.
I'm so sorry. This is Alina Starkov, the Sun Summoner, she said with a little pride.
I stood up awkwardly. Zoya swept me into an embrace.
It's such an honor to finally meet the Sun Summoner, she said loudly.
But as she hugged me, she whispered,
You stink of Geremsin.
I stiffened. She released me, a smile playing on her perfect lips.
I'll see you all later, she said with a little wave. I'm frantic for a bath.
And with that, she sailed from the domed hall and through the double doors to the dormitories. I stood there stunned, my cheeks blazing. I felt like everyone must be gaping at me, but no one else seemed to have heard what Zoya said. Her words stayed with me the rest of the day, through another botched lesson with Bagra, and an interminable lunch, during which Zoya held forth on the journey from Kribirsk, the state of the towns bordering the fold, and the exquisite Lubok woodcuts she'd seen in one of the peasant villages. It might have been my imagination, but it seemed like every time she said peasant, she looked directly at me. As she spoke, light glinted off the heavy silver bracelet gleaming at her wrist. It was studded with what looked like pieces of bone. An amplifier, I realized. Things went from bad to dreadful when Zoya showed up at our combat lesson. Botkin hugged her, kissed both of her cheeks, and then proceeded to chatter back and forth with her in Shu. Was there anything this girl couldn't do? She'd brought along her friend with the chestnut curls, whom I remembered from the Grisha tent. They proceeded to giggle and whisper as I stumbled through the drills with which Botkin began every class. When we separated to spar, I wasn't even surprised when Botkin paired me with Zoya.
"A star pupil," he said, grinning proudly. "We'll help little girl."
"Surely the Sun Summoner doesn't need my help," Zoya said with a smug smile. I watched her warily. I wasn't sure why this girl hated me so much, but I had had just about enough for one day. We took our fighting stances, and Botkin gave the signal to start. I actually managed to block Zoya's first jab, but not the second. It caught me hard in the jaw, and my head snapped back. I tried to shake it off. She danced forward and aimed a punch at my ribs, but some of Botkin's training must have sunk in over the last few weeks. I dodged right, and the blow glanced off me. She flexed her shoulders and circled. Out of the corner of my eye, I could see that the other summoners had left off sparring and were watching us. I shouldn't have let myself get distracted. I took Zoya's next punch hard to the gut. As I gasped for breath, she followed with an elbow. I managed to avoid it more by luck than skill. She pressed her advantage and lunged forward. That was her mistake. I was weak and slow, but Botkin had taught me to make use of my opponent's strength. I stepped to the side, and as she came in close, I hooked my leg around her ankle. Zoya went down hard. The other summoners broke into applause, but before I had a chance to even register my victory, Zoya sat up, her expression furious, her arms slashing through the air. I felt myself lifted off my feet as I sailed backward through the air and slammed into the training room's wooden wall. I heard something crack, and all the breath went out of my body as I slid to the ground.
"Zoya!" Botkin roared. "You do not use power. Not in these rooms. Never in these rooms."
Dimly, I was aware of the other summoners gathering around me, of Botkin calling for a healer. "I'm fine," I tried to say, but I couldn't gather enough breath. I lay in the dirt, panting shallowly. Every time I tried to breathe, pain tore through my left side. A group of servants arrived, but when they lifted me onto the stretcher, I fainted. Marie and Nadia told me the rest when they came to visit me in the infirmary. A healer had slowed my heart rate until I fell into a deep sleep, then mended my broken rib and the bruises Zoya had left on me.
"Botkin was furious," Marie exclaimed. "I've never seen him so angry. He threw Zoya out of the training rooms. I thought he might hit her himself."
"Ivo said he saw Ivan take her through the domed hall to the Darkling's council rooms, and when she came out, she was crying."
"Good," I thought with satisfaction.
But when I thought of myself lying in a heap in the dirt, I felt a burning wave of embarrassment. Why did she do it? I asked as I tried to sit up. I'd had plenty of people ignore me or look down on me, but Zoya actually seemed to hate me. Marie and Nadia gaped at me, as if I'd taken a crack to the skull instead of the ribs.
"Because she's jealous," said Nadia.
"Of me?" I said incredulously. Marie rolled her eyes.
"She can't bear the idea of anyone being the Darkling's favorite."
I laughed and then winced at the stab of pain in my side. "I'm hardly his favorite."
"Of course you are. Zoya's powerful, but she's just another squalor. You're the Sun Summoner."
Nadia's cheeks flushed when she said this, and I knew I wasn't imagining the tinge of envy in her voice. Just how deep did that envy go? Marie and Nadia talked like they hated Zoya, but they smiled to her face. What do they say about me when I'm not around? I wondered.
"Maybe he'll demote her," squealed Marie.
"Maybe he'll send her to Zebea," crowed Nadia.
A healer appeared from the shadows to shush them and send them on their way. They promised to visit again the next day. I must have fallen back asleep, because when I woke a few hours later, the infirmary was dark. The room was eerily quiet, the other beds unoccupied, the only sound the soft ticking of a clock. I pushed myself up. I still felt a little sore, but it was hard to believe that I'd had a broken rib just a few hours before. My mouth was dry, and I had the beginning of a headache. I dragged myself out of bed and poured a glass of water from the pitcher at my bedside. Then I pushed open the window and took a deep breath of night air.
"Alina Starkov!"
I jumped and whirled.
"Who's there?"
I gasped. The apparat emerged from the long shadows by the door.
"Did I startle you?"
he asked.
"A bit," I admitted. How long had he been standing there? Had he been watching me sleep?
He seemed to glide silently across the room toward me, his ragged robe slithering over the infirmary floor. I took an involuntary step backward.
"I was very sorry to hear of your injury,"
he said.
"The Darkling should be more watchful of his charges."
"I'm fine."
"Are you?"
he said, regarding me in the moonlight.
"You do not look well, Alina Starkov. It's essential that you stay well." "I'm just a little tired."
He stepped closer. His peculiar smell wafted over me, that strange mix of incense and mildew, and the scent of turned earth. I thought of the graveyard at Karimson, the crooked headstones, the peasant woman keening over new graves. I was suddenly very aware of the emptiness of the infirmary. Was the Korporalkai healer still nearby? Or had he gone somewhere to find a glass of kvass and a warm bed?
"Did you know that in some of the border villages,
they are making altars to you?"
murmured the apparat.
"What?"
"Oh, yes. The people are hungry for hope. And the icon painters are doing a booming business. Thanks to you."
"But I'm not a saint."
"It is a blessing, Alina Starkov. A benediction."
He stepped even closer to me. I could see the dark and matted hairs of his beard, the strained jumble of his teeth.
"You are becoming dangerous, and you will become more dangerous still."
"Me?" I whispered.
"To whom?" "There is something more powerful than any army. Something strong enough to topple kings, and even darklings. Do you know what that thing is?"
I shook my head, inching away from him.
"Faith,"
he breathed, his black eyes wild.
"Faith."
He reached for me. I groped toward my bedside table and knocked the glass of water to the floor. It shattered loudly. Hurried footsteps pounded down the hall toward us. The apparat stepped back, melting into the shadows. The door burst open and a healer entered, his red kefta flapping behind him.
"Are you all right?"
I opened my mouth, unsure of what to say, but the apparat had already slid soundlessly out the door.
I'm sorry, I broke a glass.
The healer called a servant to clean up the mess. He settled me back into bed and suggested that I try to rest, but as soon as he was gone, I sat up and lit the lamp by my bed. My hands were shaking. I wanted to dismiss the apparat's